So, welcome to the next lecture on virtual machines. Sorry that I was away the week before Easter, but now I'm back. And there was one question which I marveled about a little bit. So how many of you are TUM BWL students? Is there any? Because for them it is kind of a mandatory course in some kind of, I don't know, Vertiefungsgebiet in the masters. But so nobody of you. Okay, so that's an easy counting. So now, so Ralph explained to you about dynamic data structures, about and the heap, and the more, and also how to deal with more complicated things like arrays and structs and such things. And perhaps you notice that these that the concept of array is a bit weird for C, and that is because of this philosophical issue that in C everything is a pointer. And so that is, so in this sense, while object-oriented languages, everything is object, so in C it's a pointer-oriented language. Everything is a pointer. So in that sense, also a function is a pointer. And that is now what we will learn today. Perhaps recall today, because Ralph also told me that he has started, but he asked me to speak about that, but he asked me to make a recap on it. So this means, if I have a function and I write down and write in the name is f, okay, and I write just f in the in a line, and then what is the value of it? Then f, the value of it is not the return value, but the value of it is an address, so it's a number in some sense. And this number is what code R would has to return when for the name of a function f. And this number is just what, where do we find it? This is the start address of the code for f. And this we will also manage inside this address environment row. Row is our universal tool for memorizing such kind of information. Yeah, so the R value of a function, so the name of the function, is the start address, and that is because if the function name is considered as a constant pointer, to the start point of the to the code. Yeah? So that is worthwhile note. Now here is so that is the example which perhaps Ralf also has shown you to you. And that is important because we now may wonder how we do, what kind of phenomena may occur in connection with functions, and what kind of provisions do we have to take for the runtime system to deal with it. And the first thing what we here note is that there is a procedure, that procedures of functions are potentially recursive, like this factorial function, which may may be called from the outside, yes, several times, and may call also itself. Now, why is this a problem? The problem is that at a certain point of program execution, there could be several instances of the function f in some sense alive. Yeah? So because if you may start, the program execution starts with main, then somehow factorial of 2 must be computed. In order to compute factorial of 2, so you start here, then you go there, okay. But factorial of 2 cannot be immediately computed because 2 is not less or equal to 0. And this means that you have to do first a recursive call of factorial of 1. And also, factorial of 1 cannot be immediately computed, so you have to descend once further into the recursion of the factorial function until you call the factorial function with 0. And then you can go out and here along this way. So this means you pile up a tower of pending function calls, which have been started and not yet returned. So that is the issue, and you have to kind of keep track of how many pending calls there are. So in this sense, when I say there is a tower of pending things, that is a kind of stack. So there's a stack-wise discipline. That function call, which have been triggered the latest, will be finished first. Yeah. So once you have kind of descended here into this sequence of factorial functions, you have returned, you here called factorial 0. So this was factorial 2, factorial 1, factorial 0. Once you have the value of that, you may use this value to determine the value of factorial called for 1, and then you may use that for computing the value of factorial called for 2. Yeah. So that is the point. I think this is nothing new to you. It's amazing that sometimes that at least for beginners of programming, recursion is always kind of something which they loathe, and as they feel completely redundant and difficult to understand. While in some sense it's not difficult to understand. You just do an intermediate computation, and there's no reason why this intermediate computation for solving a large problem could not be the same problem for a smaller instance. So that is the principle of recursion. So very simple. But now we, as compiler guys, we have to construct a runtime system which can deal with it. So this means, why is this a problem? Well, every such a function like factorial has local data. So here, what are the local data of this factorial of the factorial function here in the example? What are the local data? The parameters. The parameters, the value of the formal parameter, this is kind of one piece of local data. And we must keep it separate. So because we must keep the two separate from the one and from the zero. And now, therefore, we have to, and also there's some kind of hidden local data. It's somehow when the factorial function is finished, we have to know where to jump back. Yeah, we may jump into the function, but we also have to record where to jump back when we are finished. So that we must, because factorial need not necessarily be called from the factorial function itself, it can also be called from main. So we have to know, oh, I have to jump back into main, or I have to jump back after the second call of the factorial function inside main. So I have to remember where to go to after having finished my intermediate computation. So this is also kind of local data. And so these different calls to the same function may differ in these local data. So we have kind of what is the natural solution? So we have to provide a dedicated chunk of memory to store the local data. And this is so every instance of the call of these calls, so this one, and this one has this its own area for storing local data. And this means that several of these areas of local data could be maybe present in our store at runtime. Okay? Yes. So, and that is these chunks of memory which we provide for every call to maintain local data and everything which is related to this function. This is what we call a stack frame, because these local these chunks of memory will be maintained in a stack-like fashion. In some sense, perhaps it's not so surprising that it is a stack, but in some sense it came as a surprise, so it's perhaps a stupid story, but in the old days when they started to design, I think it was Algol 60, they realized that their syntax did not exclude the possibility that a procedure A called a procedure A, and so they were frightened that they had invented something or allowed something which they don't know, which has no meaning, which somehow must be ruled out, and only then it required a little bit of extra thinking that this is not only that this is not a bug, but kind of a feature which admits convenient ways of dealing with problems, and not only a convenient way to express things, but also there's a convenient way to implement things, and only then they could keep it. By the way, at the same time, or a little bit earlier, there was McCarthy with designing the programming language Lisp, and there everything was recursion. So for McCarthy, it was it was completely clear that you need a recursion stack, and then you can deal with it. And it was only these stupid algol designers who had kind of to reinvent somehow the stack. So now, when I say we require a stack frame for implementing procedures, now we may wonder, how do we organize the data inside the stack frame? And in some sense, we are, again, since we feel free to invent the virtual machine on the fly, so we are free to organize this chunk of memory for our function at will and how we like it. And so we may only kind of come to an agreement about the information we have to store inside. So the first thing which we have to, which clearly, so there's full agreement on that, we have to store local variables somewhere inside our stack frame. We also have to store the formal parameters somewhere in our stack frame. So that is clear. And kind of somewhere in this block of memory, we have also kind of to return the function value. Oh, there's still... It's amazing. So there are still German words inside that. These things I kind of have to update. Sorry for that. So it's because probably it's in a picture. Therefore, it's has not been updated when doing the transition from German to English. So local variables, organizational cells, and these formal parameters. So once again, there's an agreement about the local variables and the formal parameters, and there's also kind of an agreement that we need some more information. And here, now, whatever it is, we will place it somewhere, this organizational information, we put it here into the frame in some place. So now we have kind of to reason about what kind of extra organizational information we have to maintain. So the first thing is, that is what I already mentioned. In some sense, every procedure call is executed in the same way. But now, once I'm finished with the call, I somehow have to know, where do I have to continue? Where have I been called from? Where do I have my result report to report to? And that is the PC old. This allows to jump back to that position where one has been called. Yeah. So therefore, we have to record it. And then there is the other thing. There is this. Then this is. What is this FP old? Well. So for that, one first has to note what is this FP. So far we only know this SP, so the stack pointer. So the stack pointer we used kind of to find the top of stack. So that is a valuable piece of information which we still will use. But then there is another. This frame pointer is. Also important because we have to solve the problem how to address the local variables. The global variables we can address relative to the bottom of the stack. But that is not possible for the local variables because they sit in different stack frames. So therefore we kind of have to maintain a reference point pointing somehow to a canonical address inside our local stack frame. In some sense, it's a pointer to the current stack frame. And then, relative to this pointer, we will find and access the local data. So here the idea is I let the frame pointer point to the last organizational cell so that the local variables receive relative addresses 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And so if I want to access the first address of a local variable, so then this is FP plus 1. So that would be kind of the idea. Now, so the frame pointer allows me to access, thus, the frame pointer allows to access the local variables of our current call. Now, if we have completed the current call, we have to return to the and continue with the execution of the preceding call. Now, where is that stack frame, and where are the local variables there? So, in order to find them quickly, we simply store the old frame pointer inside the stack frame. Yeah, and that means when we have finished our current procedure call, we kind of replace the frame pointer, because that is obsolete, by the old frame pointer. And then we are immediately back in the environment of the caller, of the calling function, and then can continue there as if nothing has happened. Yeah. So therefore, this frame pointer is storing and restoring. The frame pointer is a useful means to switch between the computational contexts of different calls. Okay, now if we have kind of found that it is useful to switch between, that the switch of contexts happens by replacing a certain set of registers with their former versions, then we could also apply the same method to the extreme pointer. What was the extreme pointer? It was a pointer into the heap, which tells us that the current stack frame, that the current stack pointer will not go across that. And this we only can kind of compute, this upper bound, we can only compute within the for the current call of a function. So this means if you call another function, then the EP is set to another value. And when we therefore go back to the former call, we therefore also have to readjust the extreme pointer. And that means we store the old extreme pointer also inside our stack frame. So speaking aside, I don't know whether Ralf explained that to you, this technique of having this extreme pointer to separate stack and heap is one way to implement the in a convenient way the need that we have to realize two potentially unbounded data structures, namely the stack and the heap. Instead of doing that by this implementation of these two unbounded data structures within one segment, we could also use some kind of other means to keep these two things separate. For example, by referring to operation system functions. So operation systems might supply us with segments of memory, and so we could use two segments of memory, one for the stack and one for the heap, and then we do not have to maintain on our own that they will not interfere, because these two segments will be kept separate by means of the operating system. Yeah.
We have to define the size of the frame.
How we will come to that. Yeah. Okay. So therefore, this extreme pointer, we use it in this implementation. But if you were to design a practical virtual machine for the same purpose, this is a design choice to use such extreme pointers or to use other techniques to keep heap and stack separate. And we show it here only that because it's an interesting technique, therefore we have built it into this machine, but there would be other choices. Yes?
So in case the function call causes the extreme pointer to be increased,
yes,
but the heap has already overrun this new point of the extreme
then there would be a segmentation fault, just by the call, triggered by the call.
Yeah,
we would detect and immediately. But that's a good point. It could be that the extreme pointer has shrunk, or that the heap has already shrunk so much that there's not enough space anymore for that current call to be executed, and then we would detect it on the spot. So that was about the extreme pointer. Now there's only one more thing which we might have to wonder about, that this strange thing that we place the local variables above the organizational cells and the formal parameters below. And that is kind of, and for that, that we will discuss in a minute. So the first thing, as the local variables are above the frame pointer, their addresses are plus 1, plus 2, plus 3. And for the formals, at least since they are below, you see here that their address start with minus 1, minus 2, minus 3, and then decrease. So in particular, the formal parameters by this organization have negative addresses. And the reason for that is because, at least in C, it is possible to call a function with different numbers of arguments. That means inside a function, we do not know with how many arguments the function has been called. So the function does not know how many arguments it has. It is only the caller who knows how many arguments it supplies. So this, in some sense, this is a little bit, and one could say that this is an old-fashioned concept of book, but at least we find it in C, and we don't have to argue about modern or ancient concepts. We have to provide a means to implement it. And the reason is, it is made heavily use of in functions like built-in functions like printf, where you have this director string which gives a format string which says tells you about the format of the output, and then this format depends on a variable number of arguments, which and then the printf can be supplied with sufficiently many such things. And so, but you can also write your functions, your own functions, with a variable number, and sometimes it even is useful. Sometimes. But sometimes it's also only confusing. At least the possibility is there. And so the caller knows how many arguments are supplied. The function does not know. And now we see, in some sense, you might think of that this block here is provided by the caller. And then inside the function only the function call, the function itself only knows about the green stuff. And then, so for sure. And then, but if the code somehow of the function may still in some way be informed how many parameters have been passed, and then may kind of start to explore the number of the variables from in this direction. So what is the typical way how a function is informed about the number of arguments? Typically there's one extra argument supplied which simply states how many there are. So this is one convenient way to do it. And then you can read it and then kind of use pointer arithmetic to step through the arguments, given that you know at least the type of one of them. Yeah, and that is typically what you have to provide when you use this dot, dot, dot notation, that you know the the type of the arguments which will be listed. So, and then the other point, you see that not every, so maybe I have to just to, I may point you to this one here, that this memory, this a particular part of the stack frame may serve several purposes, given that these purposes kind of have non-overlapping life ranges. So, for example, here, this area I propose to use for two purposes, namely for the formal parameters as well as for the return values. Because as soon as you build up as you have created the return values, then you will no longer have to access the formal parameters, and therefore you can override the formal parameters. You could also, for clarity, have separate areas for these two kind of uses of memory, but then in some sense the portion for the formal parameters would be unused during the time we do the computation and only used in the very end. And it's so here we also use a simplification. So in principle, return values can have arbitrary size. Here we kind of restrict ourselves to make life simple, to the simple case where the return value is just a single memory, occupies a single memory cell. So it's only a pointer, an int, or a floating point value. In the very first versions of C, it was like that this was mandatory, but I think very soon people realized that it might be useful also to return structs and composite values. So if you return an array, what will happen? If you return... Now there is perhaps you say. Yeah, then you return. You said you one would return the offset of the first element, which means one returns a pointer. So this is one memory cell object. So now. We have a new language feature, and we made up our minds how to organize memory, but now we have also to generate code, and we realize that we have to generate two kinds of codes. The first thing is we have to generate code for the call of a function somewhere in another function. But there's another thing which we have to generate, and which is a code for the body of the function. Clearly, the implementation somehow also has to provide it somewhere. Okay, so these two tasks, and we will try to kind of give solutions. Before that, both we have to think about one further. We require, in order to do so, we require another prerequisite, which is the right address environments. So it turns out that now we have several kinds of variables. We have, and these variables differ in the visibility, and also differ in how we will maintain them at runtime. So the first thing is those variables, or those which we kind of silently have considered so far only, these were global variables. Yes? Because we assumed that they sit somewhere in the stack at a fixed place, and we can address them by using their absolute addresses. Yeah? And these kind of variables will still be available. These are the global or external variables, which are outside, defined outside of functions. Besides that, there are other functions which are local. Their life range is limited to the to a call of a function. So these are local functions. Sometimes they are also called intern or automatic. And here's a K. This is incredible. We will allocate space in stack space inside the stack frame of a particular function, and they will be addressed not absolutely, but relative to the current frame pointer. Okay, and therefore, since they have to be treated, these two types of variables have to be treated in a different way, we kind of have to distinguish them, and this means the address environment, therefore, will have tags, which together with an address. And addresses, as we have seen, are now no longer only positive, they could also be negative. So therefore, these relative addresses are in arbitrary integers, and as tags we use global or local. Okay? And that is this distinction between global and local. This is kind of the minimal distinction which is interesting or which is required for such kind of for the translation of functions, but typically there are many more finer grades of visibility of variables and life ranges. So sometimes there are variables which are only visible inside a particular file, or this would be for C, this is important, or they are visible only for, they are global, but visible only for all calls of a particular function. So these are the static variables there. So in this sense, they are global and will be translated like global, but they are only accessible from inside certain functions. So these things could be available in C, but if you think of other imperative languages, there are even more, think of Java, then you have all kinds of weird restrictions where and when certain variables are visible. And usually these restrictions in visibility, the goal is kind of to support encapsulation, so that you kind of an information hiding, if you like, so that this kind of increases the increases reliability and stability of code, in that certain classes of stupid errors are excluded. Perhaps I'm sorry for boring you with these anecdotes, but there is this other old-fashioned language which is COBOL. For example, there everything is global, so that is kind of this makes it in some sense easy. You don't have to reason about visibility; everything is visible. But it makes life hard because if you want to have data only for your function, then or procedure there, then you have to invent new names, and that means, and if you have by chance make a name clash or so, then this means you override other data and nobody will complain. Only the program will be broken. And so for that, then people try to adjust for that to compensate that by introducing, so when they make a variation, for example, of a function, of a procedure, then the first thing what they do is they copy all the variables and make another name tag to it, so by an extension. So this is kind of, and in this way, then they have the copy of the, and then they can start modifying the code. And sometimes they started to do that and to do this modification of an existing procedure. So they have already done the copying, and then but then they discard the new function. But then how can you discard all, remove all the copied variables? Because these are just variables. So it's very dangerous to remove variables from your code. It could be that somebody uses them. And so in this sense, all these old COBOL codes are completely, I would say, they are. There's a huge amount of such copies of variables which are never used, and full of dead code. And yeah, so this is a strange thing. And that for that reason, this seemingly trivial feature of having local and global variables is very helpful, because you can call them all the same. All locals could call them X, Y, and Z, and no, but it would not harm the semantics. So okay, so that's just a little. Sorry for that little detour. That's about visibility of variables. Okay, so now let us see what kind of address environments we would find in a program like that. So the first thing is that we note is that there are here some global data which are introduced right at the beginning. Then there we find here that there is a first function definition, and then here is another function definition. And we see, so looking even closer, that there is an integer, so there is a program variable I here, and here is a formal parameter I. And what else do we see? So, and we wonder at which, in different places, therefore in different places of the program, the same name I will refer to different entities. So, for example, if we are here looking at this occurrence of the name I, where does it refer to? This is inside the main function, which I is meant here. The global one, yes, because this, if I kind of make maybe in blue, the scope where this the formal parameter I is used, then this can only be used inside here, while this I therefore refers to this to the global I. Okay. Now, what happens with the global I inside the function in the function indexed one with the number one here? What is I?
It's shadowed.
It's shadowed. This means it is still there, but it cannot be accessed because there is another program entity with the same name. Okay. So, and therefore we could say we could the address environments which we find here would be the first one, this kind of the basic one, which is outside of the function definitions, which contains the global variables. Here are the globals, and then also the names of the procedures of the functions, which are also defined outside, which are visible outside, which are generally visible. Well, we must be a little bit careful. This address environment, this top, if you like, top level address environment is incrementally built up. So it is, therefore it would not be, if this code occurred here, then this would be problematic. Why? Yes, because at that point, this this name Ith has not yet been defined and therefore cannot be used. So this is kind of a little bit different from the methods in a class in Java, where you may call even a method which will occur later in your class. So there, they are a little bit more liberal, but here in this, the C language kind of is considered to be one pass kind of translatable. So this means at a particular point in the program, you only have seen what you have seen, and only these things can be used. Okay, so what does one have to do if one wants to place the definition of main before the definition of if? What kind of, yes, one has to provide a function declaration first, but what kind of function declaration?
Prototype.
A prototype, yes, thank you. Yeah, you just have to provide the name with the parameters, and that's sufficient for the moment. So now the compiler knows this will be, it will hopefully arrive, the definition later, and then you can use it. Okay, so that is outside, so in this sense, this... yeah, so therefore, here in this sense, this slide is not completely, it's a little bit simplifying the situation, because outside the function definition, it depends where we are. So here, this is a situation before the definition of ith, this is the situation after the definition of ith, and this is the definition after the, this is the situation after the definition of main. And then this dot, dot, dot stand for all the other functions which here, occur, like the scanf and the printf, and for example also the scan list or whatever. Yeah, so these kind of functions, they are not defined here, they hopefully are imported by made visible by some kind of library. Okay, so that is kind of the top level, these things which are defined on top level. Then now if we enter, so in that sense, I think this is even wrong. This M is not available inside here. Inside ith, we know the... so now, the name I. So we what there is a parameter I, named I, of this function, and there is the global variable I. But as we have agreed upon, the global... In this case, the global variable is shadowed, and so it's not visible anymore, and the variable which is visible is the formal parameter. So that means in this address environment, inside, which is responsible for the translation for, and for the code of the procedure ith, the I will be refer to the... I think it's the second formal parameter counted from the right. No, yeah, it's the second formal parameter. I would have said that this should be, since we start translating the formals from the right, so it should actually it should be -3 then. And x is counting from the right, the second one. So this would be then... so it depends. So how we kind of count, how we number the... four. And then comes the L. This is a refers to the global to a global variable. And therefore, this is the same as this one. And this one, yeah, this is also the same as here. And this one, I said, we would not have, we would not see inside the function ith. Yeah, and that is now. Was I right? Sorry. No, I think I have confused myself. I think this I that this is minus. From right to left first. No, I think this is right. I was wrong. Sorry, I was wrong. So this -4 and -3 is is the correct address, and the argument is this one here. Contrary to our perhaps to our intuition, we will evaluate the actual parameters. So typically we start evaluating from left to right. So this is in some sense a natural way. But here it turns out that it is meaningful to do it in the opposite ordering. So we start at the rightmost parameter and evaluate it first and put it on top of the stack. Then comes the second rightmost parameter. We evaluate it and put it on the stack. And the leftmost parameter, therefore, is on top of the stack. And therefore has the leftmost parameter, therefore, has the smallest negative address, the largest negative address. So this means the -3 here. So therefore, and why is this? Why in this ordering? Because of this variable number, so this means that the variable tail is, so to speak, farthest away from the frame pointer. And therefore, we put it down there. And the leftmost, which we are the most sure that it is available, so the sure parameters are on the left end of the parameter list, they sit on top of the parameter list. And therefore, they receive the relative addresses -3, -4, and so on. So therefore, here in our particular situation, where the leftmost is x, the next one is I. So x will therefore receive -3 and I -4. And that is what I have written down here. And that was correct. So I was not so stupid when I wrote these slides, but this line still is wrong. Okay. So, now if we kind of want to do this, want to calculate these relative addresses for the formal parameters, we can do it in this way. So so here in the example, it is particularly simple because the x and the i have size 1. But if they have larger size, what will we have to do? Well, okay, so we have to kind of point to the first address. So therefore, we have to subtract, and since we have here these negative things, we have to subtract the size of the first parameter from the 2, and that is from the -2, and that is the lowest relative address, the lowest address which where the formal parameter, where the actual parameter starts. And starting from that, we then, if we want to go to the x2, then we have to subtract further the size of the second parameter, and so on. Okay? So these are the formulas how to compute the relative addresses for the formal parameters. And and here's again, strangely, the backslash is missing. Sorry. Here, the backslash, which turns the word into a command. It makes it a nice LaTeX appearance. Okay, so now inside the function main, we have, so there we have these, this is... The I and the L refer to the global variables. So therefore, they are taken from the row 0. The K is a local variable, which is the first local variable, and therefore has the relative address 1. And the ith and main, this is now true. These are both visible inside main. And and these are marked as global. Okay, so now we have the relative addresses, which we then will use when we have to translate expressions. So there we will have to refer to these addresses. Now, before going to... let us kind of take a closer look at the the key functionality which we have to provide when we want to implement functions. And this is, we have to wonder, what do we have to do when we call a function and when we return from a function. And these then, now this will kind of give us a sequence of actions which we have to execute at runtime. Now that is one thing, so that is the runtime view, and then now what does that mean for the compiler? The compiler has then to kind of split up these sequences and distribute and has to decide where to place these code sequences. So some of these code sequences will be placed inside the caller, and some of the code sequences will be placed inside the called function. And clearly, inside the so the key point is that once we know what we have to do when the function is called and when it is returned, we have to do this. Have to decide on this distribution, and this distribution is not arbitrary. We can kind of do actions in the called function, place code for certain actions in the called function only if the code only depends on information which is also available in the called function. If it refers to information which we do not know, well, then we cannot generate code for it. For example, argued earlier, the number of parameters is not known to the called function. It is only known to the caller. Yeah, so therefore, everything and also the actual parameters, they are not known to the function because the function is called for different kinds of parameters, but it is only known to the caller. So therefore, evaluating the parameters and handing them over to the called function, this is a duty which must be realized by the caller and not by the callee. Yeah? So that is the thing which we have to take care of when we try to distribute, when we try to realize the sequence of actions for the call and the sequence of actions for the return. So here's, now let us look at the call. So let us assume that the function which is called is the function G. So now what do we have to do? Okay, so obviously we will have to evaluate the actual parameters because there's G applied to something. And these somethings must be evaluated before we can call the G. And that is, so this is, so these actual parameters obviously are written down, the expressions which are evaluated to the values of the actual parameters are provided in the caller, which is this function G. I should also mark it red. This function F. So F calls G. Yeah? Okay. So that is about, okay, the actual parameters, that is easy. Now then there is, we recall that in this organizational registers, we have agreed that we want to store the old frame pointer and the old extreme pointer. So the old frame pointer and the old extreme pointer are only known to the caller, to F and not to G. So these are, saving them can only be done by F. Now, the start address of G. Okay, so that is, if the G is just the name, then this is kind of globally known. But if this G could also be kind of an expression itself, which must be first evaluated before we arrive at the address. So, for example, it could be it's a kind of a nice or a frequent pattern that you have structs and they are function pointers. Kind of poor man's object-oriented programming, which is quite frequent. So you that means you have the struct, you have to select the component, you have to access the value of the component, and then you obtain your function. Yeah. So this has a little bit of computation to compute the address. So this is something which typically can only be done by the function f, by the caller, because there's the expression which evaluates to the runtime value of the runtime start address. Okay, so now there's the saving of the PC and jumping to the beginning of the computed function. That is again something which is nicely done by the caller, yeah, by F. And also, okay, so if I have already put all information about the parameters on top of the stack, and also have dumped the FP, the old FP and the old extreme pointer and even the old PC, then I can already set, but then I can perform the task of setting the frame pointer, the new frame pointer. Therefore, this can also be done by the function F. Okay, but then there is other kind of things like allocating the local variables, which you have to do before you can start executing the code for G. That is something which only can be done by G. Why? Because the caller does not know the code of G, because it could be in a different file. So it could think of separate compilation. You call a function, but you do not know its implementation. And you do not want to know its implementation. You just want to call it. Yeah? Therefore, the locals can only be allocated by the called function. And also, the new extreme pointer can only be set by G itself, because only G knows its own code. Only, and knowing you must know the code in order to know how much space it will consume. Therefore, these two tasks can only be done by G. And here then I have listed kind of these tasks. We actually do not really know, not for everything, how we can implement it with our current set of instructions. Therefore, we will introduce new instructions. So this mark will be responsible for saving FP and EP. The call will adjust will save the PC, jump to the new address, and also set the new frame pointer. And enter and alloc will be executed by G. So, but you do not have to recall that. Remember that list on the directly here. I will explain them in detail later. Okay, so now that was for the call. And also, perhaps one more thing, by just listing all these activities, we see that at first sight it seems very complicated what to do when a function is called, but here you see that it is kind of, it's not so much. Yeah, it's only a few activities, and once having kind of done this requirement specification, we then can kind of work through the list of items and just produce an implementation of it one after the other. And then each of these small tasks is very small, and we can easily implement it. So in that sense, the same. So we might wonder whether the same holds true for the returning of the procedure. Maybe this is also not so complicated. So the first thing is, when terminating finishing a returning from a function, the first thing is, if there is a return 5 or so, then or x plus 5, then we first have to evaluate this. We have to evaluate this return expression. That is one thing, and then we have to store this return, the value of this return expression somewhere in the stack frame. So this storing, this is the the first thing which we have to do, and after that, nothing more happens inside the called function. So the code there is finished, and the only thing is, we now have to transfer control back to the calling context. And that means, in particular, we have to restore the old registers. So we have to restore the old PC, the old extreme pointer, the old stack, have even re-establish the old stack pointer. And so perhaps here one might wonder whether this SP is perhaps done a little bit later. And then we have to jump back to the into the function F. And that is the same as restoring the old PC. By that, we jump back into the where we came from. And then we are almost done, but there's only one more thing. We have this this variable number, this kind of subspace of the stack frame, which refers to these dynamic parameters. The length of these dynamic number of parameters, or variable number of parameters, which the called function does not know, but the caller knows. And this is kind of this readjusting of the and popping off this this unnecessary parts of the parameter list. This is something which can only be done by the by the caller. This is this one. And by that, then the stack pointer, and in some sense, if you could think of it like that, here is these unknown parts of the parameters, which the called function is not sure whether it is there or not. Then here, on top of that, we expect that there's the return values. Return values, and here are these variable parameter list. And then what must happen? Then this blue part, this is the one which we really want to have. The green part we must squeeze out of the stack. So we must kind of slide down the return value and by that copy it to the lowest address down there and adjust the stack pointer. That is the task of the sliding. Okay? So that means, so here, then if these are the activities which we agree upon that they should happen at a call and at a return, then we can put them together and produce code for the for a function call first. So here's the code for a function call. So it the form of it is G applied to a list of parameters. So the G is itself an expression. So then we said we will evaluate the parameters from right to left. So we start with EN, the rightmost parameter, and so on, and evaluate until E1. Okay, so that was the first task, evaluating the parameters. And the next step is we wanted to save certain organizational registers, which kind of are these middle, these organizational overhead, which kind of, if you could think of it as this constructs or constitutes the stack frame. And this is here implemented by means of, I make it in red, the new instruction mark. And we have to implement this instruction. We don't know yet how it is implemented. And following that, we continue. Then this is responsible for saving the frame pointer and the extreme pointer. Then the next thing what we do is we have to evaluate the expression representing the function to be called. This is done now. Now, as a result of that, that sequence of instructions which we generate here, on top of the stack, we will see an address. And now this is the input situation for the next instruction, which we have not yet seen. This is this call. Yes, the call then kind of, what should it do? It should kind of save the PC old, and then jump to this address which has been supplied on top of the stack. This is the call. Yeah? And then, now the next instruction, so here, in some sense, you kind of must, I perhaps make it in black. So here, this is the line where control kind of is handed over to the call function. And then after the black line, below the black line, this is the first instruction which is executed when the execution of the call function has terminated. Yeah? So, and that is the first activity which now is again inside the function inside the caller. And here we do the sliding, which means we kind of squeeze out the actual parameters and move the return value down to the and give by that pop off the stack frame. Okay? Yes?
Isn't slide like a function? Isn't like slide a function that it uses parameters?
No, but that is kind of a number. M is known at compile time. So it's slide 50. And so we feel free to put constants into the instruction. We have also this load constant 5. This is the same thing. And here it's always small numbers. So there's no problem with that. Yeah. Okay. So there's one more thing to note, that here we are in this part we evaluate expressions, and the question for expressions, we have learned there's always two possibilities, either L value or R value, and here we always compute the R value. So we really want the value, the addresses do not matter. So this is due to that C has a call by value semantics. So actually it's in some sense the default, probably many of you have never used any other programming language which has not passing parameters by value. But this is one of the reasons why the R value of an array is just its address. Because the old C designers thought arrays are too large to be copied by value. So, and therefore they said arrays always must be copied, handed over by as an address, which is actually the L value also. And therefore they said an array is a pointer, and so they hand over the pointer. Yeah? That is one of the reasons. But generally, it's always code R, which we apply here, and the same is also here. For the function G, the G could be a pointer or something. We take the R value of it, and this is just the address of the code. Yeah. Still, here, strangely enough, here's still some German things. I thought I would have changed that. For some reason, it has survived. It's amazing. It's really amazing. But I will change that and update the slide accordingly. So therefore, I would therefore kind of repeat again. Also for function names, these holds the same applies as to arrays. They are considered as constant pointers thus the R value of such a beast is again is just the address. interestingly, there is a strange thing that what happens if I have a pointer to such a thing? And there is a weird a weird situation that the expressions star 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 G are all the same as G. So you can dereference a function as often as you like. You will always have the same function. I don't know whether that is how sensible this is, but this means you can kind of normalize it and simply remove all the stars in front of it and get the same effect. yeah. But that also means that if I kind of that I can hand over a function to another function, and that means in essence I hand over the pointer to the function, which means I hand over the address. Yeah. Okay. Now there's another small point with that. In so this. The using code R here is at least according to our current technology, we know how to do deal with it if expressions. Yes?
Slide wasn't mentioned on the return.
Once again?
Slide wasn't mentioned on the return. So slide we have to use also at
all. Here is the slide. And that is already here is the line. The things on top of the line are executed by the called function, and below the line is executed by the caller. So therefore this slide here shows up here. Yeah? More questions? Okay. So there's one more point, minor point, and that is expressions. Actual parameters which are passed could not only be of size 1, but could also be structs or things like that. So that is, R values need not necessarily have size 1. And then the question is, how do we do then, pass them as parameters? Well, and the idea is is this one here. So we extend our code R scheme to values which are not just of size 1 in this way. So if it has if it is a structure of size larger than 1, then we first determine the starting address of this beast and then move the number of elements on top of the stack. Then again on top of the stack the new value is kind of accumulated. So here is the move. Assume that we have created a struct somewhere, have a struct somewhere, and filled it with values, and then we now pass it as a parameter. We said we first kind of place the address, the L value, representing the L value of the struct on top of the stack, and then call this move k, and this will then simply take these k elements and put them on top of the stack. This means this move k removes one element from the stack and instead adds k elements. And the k is part of the instruction, so if I have move 5, then it has one argument and 5 results, so therefore ultimately the stack size increases by 4. So in this example k is 4, then this means the size of the stack increases by 3. Okay, and perhaps it's a very minor remark, we have to copy a block on top of the stack, and for that we somehow require the base address which is sits on top of the stack. Therefore, we kind of use this iteration where we, or this is one way how to implement it, that we start the iteration with this address and place it there, followed by that in the next, and only copy the bottommost address as the last one. And the reason is only then this last one will override the value at the old stack pointer, which we require for the iteration. Yeah? This is a minor point. You all know that if I overwrite my arguments which I used during the iteration, then I am doomed. Okay? But that is only about the implementation of the move. The idea is we just move this block however we howsoever we might want to implement it. So that was for the passing of parameters. Now let us think about this instruction mark. So the idea of the instruction mark, once again, it was it should kind of say, put the, this instruction is used after the actual parameters have been evaluated. And what it does is it saves the old frame pointer and the old extreme pointer. And that's it. And now if you have agreed on that, then this is a very simple operation. We just take the extreme pointer, here it is, and copy it onto the stack, take the old frame pointer and copy it onto the stack. That's it. Okay? Now the next thing is the call. So the call, once again, when this instruction was placed, after we have evaluated the expression denoting the call function. So on top of the function, we have an address, or we expect an address of a code address, where we and this is the address where we want to jump to. So this means this address somehow has to move inside the PC. But at the same time, something more has to happen, and that is the old PC must be, which is overwritten by this activity, must be saved on top of the stack. So this is this activity. And then there is a third activity, and this is that we that the frame pointer is set to the new frame pointer is set. The frame pointer is still the old frame pointer, and we want to set it to the, we want to generate the new frame pointer, but what is it? It is just the stack, the SP. Yeah, so that is kind of the third activity which we want, which we delegate to this instruction call. Now, and so you see, this kind of thing that the current PC is dumped onto the stack, and that the PC is overwritten with the address where we want to jump to. This kind of activity is typically supported by hardware instructions. So the call instruction in any hardware I know of does exactly this thing. Only that the call instruction typically does it for a fixed address. But if it's a dynamic address, which I do not know at compile time, then there is something. I think PowerPC is something like jump and link or so, which takes the variable address, which is only known at runtime, and does the same thing with that. And here we additionally let the call instruction set the frame pointer. And now we see this is not, it seems as if it were a complicated activity, but it's a very short code. Okay, so now we have the call. What else is missing? Now the only thing, so now we have the what we have implemented, the callers activity before the callee is starting. Now there was one more activity, namely this slide thing at the end. And now what does slide mean? Well, we expect on top somewhere on top of the stack the return value, and below that there is garbage. So here is garbage, which we want to squeeze out of the stack. And so that means we take this value and copy it down there, and afterwards adjust the stack pointer to this cell. And that's exactly what the slide M does, where M is the number of memory cells which is squeezed out of the stack. And you see here in our little scheme, so this was what we squeeze out is 1 minus the size of the actual parameters, because the topmost cell has been occupied by the return value. And you see here also how to modify that in case one has multiple return values, because then one would slide down not just one memory cell but several ones. So that would be possible as well. Okay, so that was for the... Yes, please. Yeah, that is good. That's a good question. So in that case, one better should kind of have still allocate one thing, so that then there would be a slide zero. So now that was for the call, function call. Now let us look what happens for the function definition. So function definition is like that. We have a return value, return type. We have the name. We have specifications of the formal parameters, and then we have a block representing the function or procedure body. And here, for simplicity, we may assume that all variable definitions are at the beginning of this block. This is not necessary, as you know, this is not necessarily the case. They can be arbitrarily dispersed over the blocks occurring inside the body. But anyway, we would, in this case, the compiler would kind of collect the maximal amount or for simplicity, what you could even think of that the compiler concatenates all the local variables or collects all the local variables declared somewhere in the body and allocates sufficiently much space at the beginning of the execution of the block for all local variables in one go. And that certain local variables become visible or come into existence only later during execution of the function body. This is a matter of the static semantics, and the compiler will ensure that. But for the runtime system does not care. It allocates these variables right at the beginning, typically. It's not necessary to do it like that, but this is the typical way how compilers do it. Okay. But here for simplicity, we simply assume that all variable definitions are right at the beginning of the block of the function body. And then what we would do is we would first... Well, the essential thing which we have to do is this one. We have to generate code for the body of the function, but this we is kind of before that. We first have to allocate sufficiently much space inside our stack frame. This is done by this alloc, and also have to initialize the new extreme pointer, and this is by this enter. So these two instructions, therefore, will precede the code for the ordinary body of the function, and afterwards we will have the one instruction, which is instruction return, and this will serve for the restoring of the registers and kind of returning control to the caller. And so these three things then have to be discussed in sequence. So we have perhaps 2 minutes. I don't know whether we get all three, but at least this enter thing is so simple that we can easily do it. So enter simply means that enter Q. This means that relative to the current stack SP, we kind of adjust the extreme pointer. So that is the first thing what we do. So this Q must have been computed by the compiler before generating this instruction. And this should be the maximal number of stack cells which will be occupied by instructions inside the current call of the procedure, of the function or procedure. And once, now this EP could be too large. I think this question we have already had before. It could kind of exceed or be at least as big with the current extension of the current amount of heap memory which we have already allocated. So if this happens, so this can be detected by comparing it with a new pointer. So if we detect a clash, meaning that EP is the new EP is equal or larger than the new pointer, then we have stack overflow. And then we give up. And otherwise, we continue. So that was for the extreme pointer. And alloc is equally simple. This says, okay, so I found I need k memory cells for my local variables. Then I simply increase the stack pointer by k. That's it. And I think that is the two simple things. The return instruction is just a little bit, you see the code is not so large, but it is, we have to think a little bit what the return instruction should do, and that we will do tomorrow. Thank you very much for your attention, and see you tomorrow.